Your Steve Jones Show podcast audio is loading. Steve Jones Show podcast, sponsored by Kratzer Insurance Agency, Mount Pleasant Mills in Northumberland, and online at KratzerInsurance.com.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Kratzer Insurance. Our good friends, Mount Pleasant Mills and Northumberland, presenting the Tuesday edition of the show. Auto, home, life, business insurance. They have a very simple motto. Very simple. And it is a motto by which every business should live by. Service and price mean everything to them because it means everything to you. That's Kratzer Insurance, Mount Pleasant Mills, and Northumberland. Quite a show coming up today. Larry Schenck, for 44 years, the Baron was the public relations director for the Philadelphia Phillies. He wrote a book, If These Walls Could Talk. Larry's the wall. He listened to a lot over the 44 years, from Dick Allen to Dallas Green to Pete Rose to Steve Carlton, Tim McCarver, Mike Schmidt, all the way up to Ryan Howard, Chase Utley, Cole Hamels. He spans all of that, from Connie Mack Stadium, Shibe Park, to Veterans Stadium, to Citizens Bank Park. 44 years with the Phillies. We will talk to him at 3:35. Open line time from 4:06 until 4:30, and then Scott Goodyear from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to preview the 500. Another Kevin Herr-inspired moment.
It was nice to talk to Scott Goodyear in person last year at Pocono, too. Had a chance to chat with him on the Friday before the race up at Pocono, and as he was coming in, was having some fond memories of Nazareth as he drove by the Nazareth Speedway, which is now looks like, well, Indy did in the 40s when nobody was racing there. Weeds all over the place.
Yeah, unfortunately, I took some time the other day when you talked about that to look at the pictures. Now, I guess they took the grandstands out.
Yeah.
And they moved the grandstands to... Grandstands are at Watkins Glen.
Is that where they went? I didn't know where they went.
Yeah. I believe the grandstands at Nazareth went to Watkins Glen, which I believe is also a Penske-owned facility. The value of the property at Nazareth, you know what the property value is?
Oh, I have no idea.
$18 million.
Really?
Well, first of all, you're
talking
about...
I guess I won't buy it then, huh?
Well, you're talking about an area where the track is, obviously, it's a mile around. And the track is still there, but they have weeds growing in it, trees are growing in it, cracks in the pavement and so forth. And they still have, the walls are still painted, but it's all flaked and, you know, being scraped away. But the acreage involved there, because it's a mile around track, the tract of land is worth $18 million.
Well, it's actually, on the sales block now yet, isn't it? Didn't they do that a few years ago?
It's still for sale.
Yeah, I didn't realize how much it was worth at that point, but I know it's been like 9 years since there's been a race there.
Right. And it looks it. But the stands that were taken out were taken, and my understanding is were brought to Watkins Glen.
You know, Steve, I watched one of the last... Well, it was an IndyCar race at that time, but one of the last races, actually, I think it was officially kart at that point, that they had at Nazareth. And one of the things that was really nice about Nazareth Speedway, it was very unique in the way it was set up. It wasn't a true oval. You know, it was along the lines of a Pocono, very unique, no other circuit like it. But you could see basically the entire track from the stands.
Well, that's good.
I mean, no matter where... And in the infield, it was the same way. In the infield, you had a great view of all the turns, you know, all 360 degrees around you. It was very, very, I thought it was, anyway, very, very friendly, fan-friendly that way.
Yeah. And, you know, they're never going to bring it back. It's just not the way it is. Just not going to bring it back. Yeah. I think the biggest plus out of that is that it's put more focus on Pocono, and bringing IndyCar racing back to Pocono is huge.
Oh, very
much
so.
That's not a small deal. It's a big deal. And a smart business move by the Pocono people.
Well, we talked about it a couple of times, and you know, they talked about it with us last year. By the time Friday rolled around, they had sold as many tickets for the 400, the Pocono 400 last year, as they estimated they would sell in general. And they sold even more on the following Saturday as well.
Right. Well, exactly. And that's a big part of it. And they've done a, you know, they've done a good job of promoting it. They certainly let us on the property to talk about it as often as they could. And when we were there, they couldn't have been more accommodating. So that'll be coming. And they've expanded it to 500 miles. Indy needs more. The Indy series needs more oval racing. People want to see speed. You can change it up once in a while. It's like golf when they used to go up to Colorado and they play, you know, one tournament where they had the Stableford system. You know,
right.
You've got the Accenture Match Play Championship. Okay, that changes it up. But in the end, there's a certain style that's expected. And look, in Indy, you know, they cannot get on enough ovals, in my opinion. Super speedways. I'd love to see Indy go to Talladega.
I wondered if that had been ever discussed. I thought, same with Daytona. Is there something, and I don't know, believe it or not, as much of an IndyCar fan as I am, I don't know the reason they haven't been at Talladega or haven't been at Daytona. I don't know if there's a layout issue or if they're afraid the cars will go too fast on those, on the bankings. See, that's a big problem that a lot of people don't realize. And I'll give you an example.
Well, Talladega is very banked.
Las Vegas. That's the reason they don't run at Las Vegas anymore. And that, right, that has a lot to do with the tragic accident that involved Dan Weldon at the end of the season a couple of years ago. That was because that track is banked so well that the cars, that the Indy cars can go flat out at 210, 215, and they can run three wide.
Right.
It's just too short of a track for that particular setup. Now, right, I wondered if the longer track, like a Daytona or Talladega, might make it better.
Well, I think when it comes to the series, they can't get on enough speedways.
You're right.
For my liking, because people want to see speed. You know, single lane, left, right turn, you know, where you're trying to snake your way through. I'm sorry. It's just not, like, okay, fine.
To me, three would be the max. No more than four. Because I know there's some heritage races that they'd like to keep.
Oh, that's fine. Like I
said, more than four.
Like I said, in tennis, you play on clay, you play on grass, you play on artificial surface. Okay, I got it. That's fine. Okay, and that's what makes the Grand Slam unique, because, you know, the French Open's clay court, Wimbledon's grass, and it's different. Okay, so it really does give you an all-around champion. Same thing when it comes to golf. Whether it's the Linkside course or the setup of the U.S. Open, the consistency of the Masters, or a great golf course for the PGA. But they used to throw in that, you know, up at Castle Pines, I think it was, the Stableford system for scoring, just to change it up. Fine. Accenture Match Play Championships, just to change it up, okay, with seating and so forth. Change-ups are fine, but there's certain things that people expect. A couple of notes for you. Let's go to the NFL. Eight players suing the league, saying that they were injected just to keep them playing. Three former members of the 85 Bears, Dave Van Horn, one of them, Jim McMahon, Richard Dent, a part of this. They're suing the NFL over this. They have tabled the idea for the moment of expanding the playoffs from 12 to 14 teams.
Good. I table it forever.
Yeah, it's not going to be.
I know it's not. I'm willing to concede that fact, but I'm glad it didn't happen this year.
You can expect down the road that they will go to 14 teams, one more in each conference. That means there'll be only one team in each conference, the one with the best record that has the first round bye. And you can expect probably one more primetime game, and it may not be a Saturday or a Sunday night. It might be a Friday night. It might be a Thursday night. It might be a Monday night. But expect that. They'll expand it, and they'll add one more primetime night to the playoffs.
Not a fan of expanded playoffs. I know it's inevitable. Just, I'm not a fan of it. I don't think you should ever have half your teams make the playoffs at any sport.
Well, 14 wouldn't be half.
No, but at one point they had talked about going to 16, and that's why I said there's no way that a half should ever make it.
All right, I understand that. I'm just reporting what they're going to do, and I'm giving you an idea of what I think they're going to do.
And you're absolutely right. It is going to happen, and it's going to happen basically because there's money there.
The NFL, when we had Tony Knapp on the show last week, he pointed out in no uncertain terms, the NFL has not reached the saturation level yet. I found that to be an interesting comment from a guy that has between 6 and 8 million tickets at his control and corporate partners that he deals with all the time, that they have not reached their saturation point yet. Interesting. I think it's really interesting. You'd think at some point they would, but they haven't found it yet. They haven't found it yet. The lawsuit deal, that doesn't help, especially when you're talking about players accusing individuals of keeping them out there and playing by using injections. Now, that's from the 80s.
I was going to say, isn't that the still, Bears, some of the Bears players, yeah. Steve, that were talking about that?
Yeah, the three guys I mentioned are all Bears. Three of the eight former Bears from the Super Bowl championship team in 85. So that was brought up today. Jerry Jones is a major proponent of John Bon Jovi.
And okay.
It would not. Well, no, this is important. John Bon Jovi's trying to buy the Buffalo Bills. And if he does, he might move them to Toronto.
Really?
You're right. That's the rub here. If Donald Trump buys the Bills and is part of a consortium to buy the Bills, they would stay in Buffalo. If John Bon Jovi buys the Bills, there's a possibility he might move them to Toronto. Just laying it out there for you.
Do you have any insight as to why?
I don't know.
I was just curious, you know?
I mean, is John Bon Jovi Canadian? I have no idea.
I always thought it was from the Philly, New Jersey area.
I thought he's from Jersey, but...
That's why Toronto didn't really ring a bell with me.
No, that's my understanding. That's what he would do with them. I mean, the Bills play right now. They're not going to do it this year. I think they're playing all eight home games in Buffalo this year or in Orchard Park. Now, the Bills do need a new stadium. The Bills do need a new stadium. There's Ralph Wilson Stadium, I believe, is now at least 40 years old. I believe it's older than that. I think that Ralph Wilson Stadium might be 45 years old. I mean, I think that maybe it's a little bit less than that. Maybe they play, 1 year, maybe 2 years at War Memorial Stadium.
Would Toronto even want an NFL franchise?
Yes.
Because the Argonauts have been very successful, and that season would overlap.
Kevin, they don't care. It's the National Football League.
Okay.
It's the NFL. It's like the big guy league.
I grasp that.
Okay. Nobody comes out of the draft and says, you know what? I think I'm going to sign with the CFL. What?
They do know that the field's different, right?
Yeah.
There's no 55-yard line.
The Bills play one game a year, and they're already anyway.
Yeah, I guess they do.
Now, as a market, it's a bigger market than Buffalo, but it would be devastating for the city of Buffalo. Devastating. That team's their identity. Larry Shank next.
While looking for a vehicle, you know that if it sounds too good to be true, chances are it is too good to be true. You get the runaround, gotta go from place to place. Well, you can just skip all of that and go straight to Sunbury Motor Company. Sunbury Motor Company has been satisfying more customers and selling more cars since 1915, so you know they've got it right. No offers that look good on paper or online, and then you get disappointed when you see them in person. Sunbury Motor Company offers a lineup few other auto dealers in the area can compete with. With the inventory of Ford, Hyundai, Kia, and Lincoln vehicles, there will be no problem finding the right vehicle that fits your needs and your budget. And the friendly, knowledgeable staff's ready and able to help you with everything from the test drive to the drive off the lot. See for yourself at Sunbury Motors. Sunbury Motors, Ford, Lincoln, Hyundai, in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. Look for them online anytime at sunburymotors.com.
When it comes to insurance, let's face it, the options and the sources keep changing. It gets confusing. Do you really know what you're getting? Better yet, do you know what you're not getting? Save time and save your mind with a simple call to the Kratzer Insurance Agency of Mount Pleasant Mills or Northumberland. For 51 years, the Kratzer Insurance Agency has been keeping the Susquehanna Valley insured and protected from whatever comes our way. If your policy is up for renewal, or you suffer the disappointment of cut-rate insurance deals on the internet or over the phone, then listen. Don't sacrifice personal service. The Kratzer Insurance Agent, your independent agent, has your best interest in mind. Of course they have competitive prices.
Hi, this is Kim Ebright. Call us, stop in, or visit us online at KratzerInsurance.com.
Standing together against whatever. Family, friendship, security. The Kratzer Insurance Agency.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to be with you on a Tuesday, brought to you by our great friends at Kratzer Insurance, Mount Pleasant Mills and Northumberland. When it comes to the business of insurance, they get it. They're two very important things. Service, they provide that. And price, they understand it has to fit your budget. Service and price mean everything to them, means everything to you. Auto, home, life, business insurance, that's Kratzer Insurance, Mount Pleasant Mills and Northumberland. And, of course, we're in the Sunbury Motors studio. Our good friends from Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, Kierwitz, 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. And they're just a year away from the big 100. Wow. Boy, what a story that is. That is a great story. All right. Great story, the Phillies. You go back to the years at Shy Park, Connie Mack Stadium, all 33 years of the vet. Follow that up with Citizens Bank Park. Well, there's one guy that has all three in common. And that is Larry Shank, the Baron. He's written a book entitled If These Walls Could Talk. Something tells me Larry as a wall observed and absorbed a lot of information over the years, and we are very pleased to have a man for 44 years associated with the Philadelphia Phillies, Larry Shank. Larry, welcome.
Thank you, thank you. You're not at spring practice today?
No, nothing today. No, we're... I don't. In fact, the next really big thing I do, besides doing obviously this broadcast extravaganza every day, is obviously some Spikes baseball this summer. So,
okay, all right, Spikes baseball.
All right. So, when did it first start crossing your mind that maybe I should keep some notes in life that maybe somewhere down the road I could write a book?
Well, I didn't, as I went along all those 50 years, I didn't really think of it. But then when I stepped down as a media relations vice president in 2007, a lot of people in my family said, you got to write a book. And I thought about it and didn't think much of it until October 2012 when I sat down and started writing. and went to Florida for spring training. We have a place down there, so we spent 3 months down there in the winter. Gave me a lot more opportunity to write. So in February of 2013, I sent the manuscript to 5 different publishers. 2 rejected me. One was interested mildly. The other one was very interested, which was Triumph Books. And they said, well, we like your stuff. And I was looking at it more as an autobiography. We want more stuff, more stories about the Phillies. You have 15,000 words. We have to have 65,000 to 70,000 words. Can you do it? And I like challenges, so yeah. I said, I will do it. So I had from February 2013 till September of 2013 to come up with 65,000 or 70,000 words and stories. So I just started thinking more and talked to some of the people that I work with. We talked to some former players, a lot of former players, and came up with more stories, and there it is.
What was the easiest part of this to write, and then conversely, what was the most difficult part to write?
Well, the easiest part was I did a lot of research to make sure I was actually factual. You know, I lived through all of that, but I wanted to make sure my mind wasn't playing tricks with me, you know, that it was really, because it's been a long time. But that was fun. That was kind of easy. The hard part was trying to come up with more stories, I guess. There were times last summer, maybe not at this time, but maybe in July, I'd be working at nighttime, late in the night, you know, what did I get myself into here? You know, and I don't like to write for numbers, you know. I just won't like to write, but I knew I had to get to 65,000 to 70,000 words, and I tried to take that out of my mind and just write, you know, and let it happen, and I did, you know. They took some things out because they didn't want an autobiography. They have these, Triumph has a series of these books that These Walls Could Talk. It's just not the Phillies, University of Michigan, New York Giant football team, and the Dodgers this year, and the Tigers.
Yeah.
So that's why they wanted to do more storytelling. So, you know, and I lived with all those players for all those years, you know, from 1980. I guess the hardest part, really, now I think of it, Triumph wanted stuff on Jimmy Rollins, Ryan Howard, and Chase Utley. And I said, well, I haven't been around them since 2007. I don't have stories in them. I don't, you know, don't travel with them. I'm not in the clubhouse.
Right.
I'm not asking them to do things. So I decided to come up with the scouting reports of those guys. It's just something people have not read. So I did scouting reports on those three, plus Pat Burrell and Cole Hamels and Chico Ruiz. I thought it was something. I like to write things that are different, and I like to be brief and to the point, and try to put some humor in it, make it light, and make it easy to read.
You also worked with one of the more interesting media groups, I think, in the country. I know when I was at, I went down to Dallas when Dick Girardi was inducted into the U.S. Basketball Writers Hall of Fame, and Dick was talking about working at a paper, for example, or in a building and around people were some of the legendary names. What was it like for you working as that conduit between players and a media that tried to push as far as they could?
Well, it was a real challenge, you know. Everybody thinks that New York and Boston are the media capitals of the world. They may be, but Philadelphia's right up there. We were very aggressive media. It keep you on your toes because you have to be ahead of them, and you try to be more proactive than reactive, but it's difficult. And there are many times when you're in the clubhouse after a loss and you're standing there with 15 to 20 media members and you have no players. And now you have to go to the weight room or the trainer's room or someplace and try to get players out. That isn't a picnic at all. And the worst team, I guess, was the 1993 team, that bunch of misfits. They spent after every game, especially at home, in the trainer's room, rehashing the game and so forth. So it was not fun to walk into a trainer's room saying, I need somebody to come here and talk to the media. You're kind of outnumbered, but Darren Dalton helped me a lot. He was a catcher and the leader of that team, and he would help. He said, I got ice on my knees for 5 more minutes, and Mickey, why don't you go out and help Darren? So that'd be really great. But it's a challenge. You can't see me, but I do have gray hair now, which I didn't at one time. You know, so I think that comes from it. And the media has evolved so differently. You know, when I started, everything was geared to the newspapers. You know, there was very little television. Was one game a week. You know, there was radio all the time. And then, well, TV came into being, and the writers had to change the way they wrote the story. They weren't writing game stories anymore. They needed quotes. You had the clubhouse access after games, which wasn't there when I first started. And today, I mean, the Twitter and mm-hmm. Facebook, it's mind-boggling, you know. People talk about social media. Hey, I was in social media 50 years ago. I bought writer's drinks.
What?
I'm glad you have a sense of humor.
I think that's terrific. What was it like for you to, I mean, it became commonplace, but to handle the Steve Carlton situation?
Steve Carlton was the most cooperative athlete I've been around in 1972. He did everything. We run him everywhere.
Yep.
During the season and after the season. Later on, he got burned by the media, and he came to me one time. He said, I don't see why I need to talk to the media because they take everything I say out of context. If they're going to do that, there's no need for me to talk. He said, they'd be better off to become more creative writers and wrote stuff without my quotes. And the one thing that the media respected from Steve is his policy, and he didn't bend no matter what. Policy was policy. He did not do interviews. So I had Mike Schmidt, I had Greg Luzinski, I had Pete Rose and Steve Carlton and Tug McGraw. So there was a Larry Bowa. There was plenty on the platter right there, and Lefty didn't talk. So it made it easier for me because the answer was no, you know.
Right. You mentioned Pete Rose. Talk about working around. Mike Schmidt had his own way. Pete Rose had his own way. Discuss the differences between the two.
Mike is kind of an introvert, a shy person, you know, a perfectionist. He was serious all the time. He was more outward going, had a lot of life. And he made Schmidt a better ball player because he got on him and rode him a little bit and also boosted him, you know, praised him and patted him on the back. Pete Rose was a PR person's delight. He was available after every game, no matter if he had one hit, two hits, or no hits. I never saw a player with the concentration he did as a hitter, because if he had two hits, he didn't ease up. He was going to get three. He had three hits, he was going to bear down and get four. And he was a pleasure to be with. He knew everything. He loved baseball, talked baseball. Knew the other team's injuries and who's pot and who's not. And I said to him one time, you really know.
What did it mean to you that Larry Bowa wrote the forward?
Well, Larry was I have a lot of respect for Larry. You know, he is really a true blue Philly. I saw him as a skinny shortstop in spring training, and I never forget what Gene Mock said. I can see him catch the ball. I can see him run. I can see him throw the ball. But when he hits, I don't hear anything. He was not a good hitter. He was really a weak hitter.
Right.
But he had so much drive in him, and he just drove himself into being a great ball player. I have a great deal of respect for him as a manager and as a coach. I'm so glad he's back with us again. He is to be right underneath Richie Ashburn as some of the great icons of the Phillies' history. I asked him if he would write it. You know, he said he would be glad to. He got the assistance of somebody else, but he put the words together, and it was really cool. So, you know, you need somebody to write a forward like that. My name is not that well known anymore because I'm not in the limelight anymore as a representative of the Phillies. So, Larry Bowa's name means a lot.
Baron, you also went through the ballparks. Mack to the Vet and now Citizens Bank. What were the characteristics that you liked and disliked about each?
Well, Connie Mack Stadium was a place that I went as a child, and I loved going there. I just roamed all over the ballpark. I just loved to do that. And then I got to work there, and it was a baseball park, but it was very run down. There were no amenities for the fans. It was dirty. There was limited parking. Playing surface may have been the best in Major League Baseball. The press box was really antiquated. The elevator held about three people and went about, it was so slow getting up. And you had to take the elevator because the press box was mounted from the upper deck roof. You know, you had to wait a long way to go. The offices were small and antiquated and so forth. We get to Veterans Stadium, and we had to change the way we operated because we now had 65,000 seats to fill instead of 33. And Mr. Carpenter brought in Bill Giles, the best thing he ever did, to oversee the business aspect, and we completely changed our image and so forth. One thing I didn't like about the bed, I had a nice office, but I had no windows.
Oh, jeez.
I didn't know if the world was out there, you know. But I was right next to the press box, so it was easy to go in and out of the office to the press box. The clubhouses were nice, plenty spacious and so forth. The AstroTurf, I thought, was great, but it became a problem because it's hot, very hot in the summertime. It was hurting athletes' knees and so forth. And then, you know, we didn't have much say in the building of Veterans Stadium. It was the property of the city of Philadelphia. But when we decided to get a new ballpark, we designed the whole thing ourselves with our architectural team. So we had a lot of input into the building and designing of Citizens Bank Park, and I think we did a tremendous job. It's just a beautiful ballpark. We're in the bad seat in the house. A lot of, it's everything. We had history of the Phillies in there, statues. It's just a great ballpark. And it's a ballpark. That's what we need again. We don't need 65,000 seats.
Exactly right. Of course, we can't go through and talk about any of this in the history of the club without talking about Harry Whitey and even back to Bai Sam. You obviously, you talk about, doing a lot of work with writers, but also there was a lot to do with radio and some with TV as well. What was it like working with the guys in the broadcast team?
Well, it was funny because I grew up listening to Bai Sam, and all of a sudden I'm working for the ball club with him, and he was such a nice gentleman. He was a straight play-by-play announcer, which is the way they did it. There was no color commentary like that. Strictly a play-by-play, telling you what's happening on the field. Very nice gentleman. I'm sitting in the dugout at the Connie Mack Stadium in 1965, and Gene Mock's sitting there, and this blonde guy is walking across from the visiting dugout, which was the Houston Astros dugout, Colt 45, excuse me. Gene says to me, "Larry, who is this guy?" I said, "I don't know. I think his name is Harry Callis." He said, "Well, what does he do?" I said, "I don't know. Because I see him in the press box, sitting in the press box for almost the whole game." Well, I learned that he was, I guess his first year with the Astros, he did one inning per game. So the other eight innings, he sat in the press box because he wasn't on the air. And nobody knew at the time that we would eventually have him in Philadelphia. And he and Whitey were the greatest broadcast team you could ever want. They were terrific. They blended so well together. They loved each other. And I don't know if we'll ever see anything like that again. Whitey was a character, really feisty, competitive type of personality. Great stories in the book about him. Harry was just, I never heard anybody say a bad word about Harry. And, no matter what hour it was after every game, he signed autographs outside Veterans Stadium until the fans left. He never turned anybody down.
Right.
He was great. He loved Michael Jack Schmidt. So there were times when I was traveling with the team, and after the game we'd go to the bar, and I used to get Harry stirred up because I'd say that Bob Bailey's the best third baseman in the game, and he would go berserk on me. Who do you think you're talking about? Michael Jack Schmidt's the best, not Bob Bailey. He yelled at, or not yelled at, but be chastised in that voice of Harry Callis, was just something. He loved the game. I talked to him one time, "Aren't you going to retire?" He said, "What would I do if I retired?" He didn't retire. He decided what he wanted to do.
Right. Yeah, my broadcast partner for football, Jack Ham, worked with Harry on Westwood when Harry would cross over. And he said, I'll tell you right now, Jack never said not one time a negative thing. He says he's just the nicest man. That's all he always told me, he's the nicest man.
Yeah.
In the end, when you write something like this and it comes to fruition and it takes you down memory lane, what was it like just to relive a life?
Well, I was fortunate as a kid growing up in a little town in central Pennsylvania, Myerstown. I became addicted to the Phillies, and I always wanted to work for the Phillies, broadcaster or writer or whatever. And I was rejected by them three times. And finally, the fourth time, I was in the right place at the right time. And I didn't know what to do as a PR guy in 1964. There were no handbooks. There were no instructions, no manuals. So I just did notes and stats and survived somehow, you know. When you get older, you do look back a lot. You know, I remember my father-in-law talking about his childhood and so forth, and I'm thinking, geez, I don't think I'm going to do that. But you do go back and you remember, and part of writing the book was a challenge of trying to remember all this stuff,
right,
and relive it somewhat. And I try to present it so that people would understand what I went through, you know, what it was like. I had an office at Cunningham Exchange, very small. I described what it was exactly like, you know, and it was fun. I'd been involved with other publications over the years with the Phillies, so many of them. I co-authored a coffee table book on the history of the Phillies in 2010, but I never did something by myself.
Right.
And so this is my first solo book, and my family, I think, is more excited when I came out than I was. You know, I don't want to look at it because I'm afraid I'm going to see a mistake. I keep thinking, oh, geez, I forgot this, I forgot that, you know. Well, too late, you know. Now I'm trying to think of another book in a couple of years when I'm still kicking, so we'll see.
Well, the book is entitled If These Walls Could Talk.
Right.
And I believe Larry is the walls.
Yeah, I'm the wall, yeah.
You're the wall.
You know, and I told Triumph, if you're looking for dirt and sensational stuff, I'm not going to do it. That's the way I am, you know.
Yeah,
that's for other people to do. I'm not going to criticize people because that's not the way I operate.
You know what, though?
I try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
You and I are very much the same way. It's, you know, people say to me, well, aren't you going to say something critical about it? Well, I don't feel the inclination to do it, so I know exactly how you feel.
Right, cool.
Yeah. Larry, it was an absolute pleasure, and this book is wonderful. And thank you for the time you gave us today. We appreciate it. And also congratulations on really a great career, because I know a lot of people that worked in Philadelphia appreciated your work for a long time.
Well, thank you. It's very kind of you, and I appreciate the opportunity to be on the air, and go Nittany Lions.
All right. Larry Schenk, If These Walls Could Talk. Phillies PR director and executive for 44 years. Our pleasure to have him on the show. And I hope for many of you Philly fans, it was a nice little walk down memory lane, a little stroll there for you. Scott Goodyear, next hour, he'll join us at 4:35. Half hour of open line talk coming up. We'll come back with more on News Radio 1070 WKOK.